Welcome to episode 2 of the 1987 WNBC radio documentary, The New York Knicks, Those Championship Seasons. I'm Bud Mishkin. This is a 9-episode series that I originally wrote and produced and created in 1987, voiced by my then WNBC radio colleague Gary Bridges, about one of the most beloved teams in American sports history, the New York Knicks of the late 60s and early 70s. But for much of the Knicks' NBA history before that, the team struggled. That started to change in the mid-1960s.
Basketball was New York City's game, but not pro basketball, not in the old days. Leonard Lewin.
The college basketball scandals of 51, of course, wiped out college basketball in the Garden. So that made a home and created more tension to pro basketball. The people in New York then adopted it as a reasonable replacement for college basketball, which was the total excitement in New York in those days.
But even handed the chance, it took the Knicks years to capture the city's imagination. Marv Albert watched the Knicks struggle through the 60s.
At the time, Marty Glickman was doing the play-by-play, and I was working for Marty as his backup announcer and writer at WCBS Radio. And the Knicks at that time were so bad that I think he used to try to get out of games on purpose. These were not memorable ball clubs. I used to think, in fact, that they would play the entire NBA season to eliminate, for the playoffs, one team, the Knicks.
I recall one season I broadcast for CBS Radio. I convinced them to carry the Knickerbockers. They were coming back. And that year, they carried both the Knicks and the Rangers. And my recollection is they both finished dead last. So there were poor, poor ball clubs, but then they began to build.
Leonard Lewin.
Eddie Donovan was hired to be the coach, and also he had some kind of a agreement that he was like the general manager also. In other words, he was an input in that area, although Fred Podesta and Ed Irish ran the ball club entirely, and they were making decisions, even in trade decisions and draft decisions. Well, when Eddie Donovan had to be replaced after losing, I think he had two straight seasons of 58 and 59 defeats or something like that, they made him the general manager. And in so doing, they gave him more power, more voice, in other words, more authority to make decisions. And Red Holzman was then a scout. And between Red Holzman scouting the material and Eddie Donovan having a strong personal relationship with Red, and they're being tuned into each other, knowing what it would take, they start a draft intelligently, which hadn't been done before that.
The Knicks began to turn things around with thoughtful drafting. The building process began for real in 1964.
So there were three players who you couldn't separate that were coming out in the draft together. That was Bad News Barnes, Willis Reed, and Lucius Jackson, who eventually the 76ers took. Were then the Warriors. They drafted him. So now that left the Knicks to decide between Barnes and Reed. Well, the Knicks went for Barnes. And they went for Barnes for an obvious reason. He looked like the better athlete. He was strong. He was quicker than Willis. And Willis had been in the Olympic tryouts and had a chance to look at me. He didn't look too well, but he was hurting. Nobody really knew that. So Willis didn't go in the first round. But Willis was there in the second round. Even Boston passed on Willis at that time.
I got a call that I had from Eddie Donovan saying that I had been drafted second round, 10th player, first player in the second round by the Knicks. And I tell you, I was very unhappy, really, because I was very upset, because I really thought that I was going to get drafted by Detroit. And I also, knowing the market at that particular time, felt like that if I had gotten drafted in the first round, I would have made a few more dollars.
But Willis Reed got over his disappointment when he saw that he was part of a plan.
Management at that time had made a decision that they were going to go and draft and build a team. And the 1964 team draft that year with myself, Emmett Bryant, Howie Komaj, Jim Barnes was the beginning of the building process that eventually ended up in the Knicks having winning their first championship in 1970.
The Los Angeles Lakers looked for help when Elgin Baylor's health became a question. The resulting trade brought the Knicks Dick Barnett.
What precipitated the trade, I think Elgin was experienced some knee difficulties, and I think they wanted to bring Bob Boozer in for insurance just in case Elgin couldn't perform at the level that he previously had. So the trade was made, and fortunately, the trade turned out very well for myself.
Cassie Russell was the Knicks' first pick in the 1966 draft, and he couldn't wait to play in New York.
I played in the Garden in college, and of course, I had a little bit of awareness of what it was to play in the Garden. You see, so that was a great feeling.
Princeton sensation Bill Bradley was a territorial pick of the Knicks in 1965, but he opted for higher education in England.
When I was over at Oxford my first year, I commuted and played with an Italian team in the European Cup Championships, and that meant a game or two a month. And we won the European Cup that year, which is the spring of 66. And then I didn't play or touch a ball for 8, 9, 10 months. And then one evening in the early spring of 1967, I went down to the Oxford gym. It was the first gym in Oxford's 800-year history, and I was there alone. And I started shooting and dribbling, and I suddenly became the crowd and the announcer, and it kind of unlocked the part of me that I'd closed off, and I realized then not to come back and play professional basketball would have been to deny a part of my personality that was really more fundamental than almost any other. And shortly after that moment, I came back and signed a contract with the Knicks.
After a brief stint in the Army Reserves, the Knicks would have their man.
When he finally announced that he had signed with the Knicks, he was coming out of the Army. He was stationed at Fort McGuire Air Base in New Jersey, and he had a little more time, like a week or two, but they had a press conference in Leone. And when I heard what he's getting paid, which was, I think it was $125,000 a year, because Cassie was getting $100,000, I nicknamed him Dollar Bill. That's where he got the nickname, from that first contract. Of course, $125,000 then is like $2 million today.
The Knicks were banking on Bradley's drawing power, and they were not disappointed.
The broadcast went on the air earlier, and I was actually doing play-by-play during the warm-ups. And I was announcing his shots as he was hit them, and they were lined up around the court just cheering every move he made. It was wild.
And Bill Bradley is reporting into the ball game. Miles, a pass underneath for Dissinger, lays it up, blocked by Reed, pulled down by Russell, up court with Bradley on the left, a pass to Bradley, jump shot, left side, goal! Bill Bradley connects on his first field goal attempt.
Bill Bradley made his entrance in the 1967-68 season, but it was another rookie on that staff that caught Marv Albert's eye.
I thought Walt Frazier's drafting was the first sign that this could be a special club. I don't think people realize the greatness of Frazier because he played at Southern Illinois, a team that did not get much exposure. And, you know, we had heard he's a good player, and he made his mark, I guess, in one of the tournaments at Madison Square Garden. But that, to me, was more of a turn than anything else.
I knew I could love it if they really wanted me. See, my problem was I didn't think they really wanted me. Playing in the NIT, I'd never seen fans like the ones in New York. You know, they were really basketball crazy. And I was thinking how great it would be to be drafted by the Knicks, but never thinking it would happen because they had Cassie Russell, they had Bill Bradley, they had Emmitt Bryan, they had Freddie Crawford. They had all of these guys in the backcourt, so I knew they didn't need a backcourt player.
But in spite of the talent, playing for the Knicks wasn't everything Walt Frazier had hoped for.
Well, that team was lousy. There was no camaraderie between the players. All the guys were very selfish. And I remember that I wish I had gone someplace else because I had never played on a team where guys would not pass each other the ball. And so it was very disappointing, and that's why we were losers. I mean, everything was – guys were complaining all the time. They didn't care about winning and losing. They just cared about making their points. And so it was difficult. So my role was – I knew I wouldn't get any shots, so I had to play defense. You know, that was my only way of getting in the game and make assists. Because every time somebody touched the ball, it was gone. You were not going to get it back.
That attitude changed when Red Holtzman took over as coach. and at long last, New York had a reputable NBA team. Sportscaster Don Gould.
The Knicks started to run. They get four or five victories in a row and lose one or two or three, and then they win. But they were finally over 500 and getting there, and you knew it was just probably going to take one more player.
No one could have guessed who that player would be. Leonard Lewin.
I remember standing with Eddie Donovan in the runway one night, and the Knicks were playing the Pistons, and Paul Seymour was the coach. He was a coach then. And the Knicks had always been trying to get the Butcher, so was everybody else. But before Paul Seymour became a coach, he was a personnel director. And Eddie told me that he had been talking to Paul as the personnel director, and apparently Paul didn't like the Butcher for whatever reason. So Eddie put that away in his mind and kept it. Now, when Paul Seymour became the coach, that thing was in Eddie's computer, that there might be a way to get Paul Seymour to move to Busher, because he was an institution in Detroit. Nobody would dare, the general manager, nobody would dare move to Busher.
Willis Reed had an inkling something was up.
3 or 4 days, maybe a week before that trade was made, Red came up to me and asked me, he said, because I had been playing some at center, whenever Bellamy would be taken out of the game, they would move somebody else into the four spot, and then I would play center. And he asked me, he said, how do you enjoy playing center? I said, well, that's all right, you know. He said, you know, all I can do is play. He said, well, he said, never know. He said, you might be playing center again, you know, just like that. And, you know, we just went on. I mean, I really didn't put any credence on it. And the trade actually was a big trade. It was a trade that probably was the making of a championship team because of the Busher's skills and because of what how I played in the middle of the floor and all that. It definitely was the difference of us probably winning the two championships.
I was shocked, though, if I had to choose anywhere to go, it would have been the Knicks. I mean, I've often kidded that as a player coach, I said if I was smart enough, I should have traded myself to the Celtics, you know. But if there was anywhere, because you could just see the Knicks emerging into something. I mean, you could tell, you know, when they had Russell, Bradley, and then they had Fraser, and then you knew Willis was just on the brink of exploding, and everybody knew he was playing out of position as a forward. You could just see everything just coming into place. And I guess if I had a really select where you wanted to go, I would have chosen New York.
I remember doing the first game that the Busher played for the Knicks, as it turned out, was in Detroit, and he had a terrific game, and we were the only radio broadcast the Knicks won easily.
John May comes on, replacing Dave DeBuscher, who is hugged by Willis Reed on the bench, and is getting a standing ovation from the crowd here at Cobalt, and Dave nods at the crowd. DeBuscher with a very strong game. And the crowd continues to cheer. And DeBuscher is looking around. I don't think he realizes it's for him. DeBuscher is getting a standing ovation.
After that, the Knicks went on to have a terrific finish. I mean, they were knocked out eventually in the playoffs. But you knew that this was going to be a solid club. There was no question about it.
And Walt Frazier says the trade for DeBuscher fixed a few of the Knicks' trouble areas.
Cole Mives and Bellamy, which got traded to Detroit for Dave, you know, solve one of our problems, because Cassie Russell and Comives would not pass each other the ball. They really hated each other. And Bellamy was a good guy, but he wasn't good for young players because he didn't play hard all the time. So those two negative influences were gone, and, you know, we brought in Dave, who was a good player, and then that made me a starter.
Baltimore Bullets forward Jack Maron.
The first year we lost to them in four straight. We had the very good year, but the Knicks had made a trade during the middle of the season that involved Dave DeBuscher that changed their whole season around. They had gone from a rather mediocre team to a very good team, and through the second half of the season, they were probably playing as well or better than we were.
Queens native Mike Reardon said his young teammates had every reason to believe they were on their way.
Most of the players who were coming along had come from winning programs in college, and really weren't concerned with the negative legacy of the past. They foresaw that their time was coming. Boston was still the king of the hill. Russell's years were on the way out. Most people thought he was capable of another good year or two, but it looked like a new generation was going to be taken over as the best in the league, and I think the feeling was that the Knicks could be right in the thick of things.
Once the talent was in place, it fell to Red Holtzman to make it all work together.
He had a way of coaching that I think is the ideal way of coaching, is to keep the guys involved and know how serious it is, that it's a team effort, it's an organized, everybody does everything together, but have fun doing it. So he started to create this fine system and little interplay. Like Bill Bradley used to find all, if you've traveled a lot, like we travel a lot, you're always walking away with the hotel keys. Well, they always wound up in Bill Bradley's pocket or his shoes or something. This was Holtzman. He would take the keys and stick it. You know, all these fellas knew where they was coming from. But these are the things that he instituted that kept that team a togetherness.
Larry Merchant was then a columnist for the Post.
Part of what was going on in the NBA in those days was that there was an element of show business, in that teams liked to sell themselves to the public by having high scorers. That was an easy way to get headlines. Wilt scores 50. Fulk scores 60. The Knicks didn't have to do that. They just had to play good, winning basketball to attract the fans. And the fans responded in a tremendously emotional way.
And Dave DeBuscher says the fans were there for one good reason.
Baseball's not New York's game. Hockey's not New York. Football's not, because it's, but basketball is New York's game. I mean, the game really was developed and grown and flourished in New York, and these people, all of a sudden, starving for so long and growing up in this frustration, all of a sudden there was this love affair that developed between the Knicks and the city.
The whole affair blossomed during the 1969-70 season. That story's next.
And so we have arrived at the 1969-70 season, a season remembered by New York Knicks fans of a certain age with a smile and even a few tears. It's a dramatic story, and it's the story you'll hear next time on Episode 3 of the New York Knicks, Those Championship Seasons. Thanks for listening. I'm Bud Mishkin.